Welcome to the Gymea Baptist Church Sermon Podcast. We're so glad you're listening to the pod and trust that this message encourages your heart and faith today. At GBC, we're all about partnering with God in the renewal and restoration of all things. And it's our hope that through these sermons, you'll discover the life-changing power of Jesus. If you'd like to join us in person or online or find out more, check out our website at gymeabaptist.org.au.
Normally at this time, after the prayer, if you're part of our church community, you'll know that we do things in a particular way. So we have our prayer, and then we have our Bible reading, and then we have our sermon. Today, we're doing something different. Mark, instead of doing a sermon, is going to be doing something called a first-person narrative. This is a way of telling a Bible story and preaching as though he were part of the story. Our sermon series, as you can see, is a great cloud of witnesses. And we're looking at five women in the Old Testament and looking at the stories of their life. Today, the person that we're looking at is the character of Abigail in the Old Testament. And what you're hearing is going to come from 1 Samuel chapter 25. Mark is going to tell Abigail and David's story from the perspective of one of David's mighty men. He is named Abishai, so he's one of David's mighty men.
She arrived just in time. Abigail of Carmel came riding into the ravine just as we were coming down from the hill country. She was unmistakable. Eyes like doves, hair like a flock of goats, lips like a scarlet ribbon. You get the idea. She was gorgeous. Her beauty was really well known throughout the entire region. And in her train were a handful of servants leading donkeys loaded with food. But the tribute that she brought was not the most important thing that she brought that day, not by a long way. See, it was a dangerous time for us, for David and those who followed him like myself. And not in the way that you're going to think. I mean, yeah, there was a lot of armed conflict and battles, but that never really bothered us. You see, ever since David had been anointed by the prophet Samuel, the Lord had gone with him in everything that he did. In every battle against every enemy, in every location, David was always successful. I mean, surely you've already heard of the reports of his battles against the Philistines. Goliath, surely Goliath, the sling, you've heard that story. The songs about Saul having killed his thousands, but David his tens of thousands. It's a catchy number. Whenever we went into battle, we went in with the confidence and courage that came knowing that the Lord was fighting for us. That's not where the danger lay. The danger actually came from the fact that when David was anointed king, we already had one. Saul was still king. And David's anointing was the worst kept secret in all of Israel. I mean, everybody knew that he had been anointed. Even Saul knew that David had been anointed. It was so evident that the Lord was with him. It was only a matter of time before David would become king. And David was content to wait. He didn't start a coup. He didn't start leading a rebellion. He was really careful to make sure that he didn't subvert or undermine Saul's authority and his kingship. Now, he was helped by the fact that he'd married into the family, and he was thick as thieves with Jonathan, the crown prince. It was actually Jonathan who did more than anyone else to hold his father and his friend together. And between you and me, Jonathan would have made a great king. Courageous, a leader of men. But above all, he feared the Lord. He had recognized that the Lord was with David, and instead of trying to seized the kingship for himself, he had humbled himself and become David's greatest advocate. And so for a while, between David's intentions to wait and Jonathan's advocacy, he kind of managed to navigate the complexities of being the king-elect while the incumbent was still around. But as David's victories piled up and more people noticed that the Lord was so with him, Saul's jealousy increased to the point that eventually David had to flee. His wife, Princess Michal, couldn't protect him. The prophet Samuel couldn't protect him. Even Jonathan couldn't protect him. And he was forced to flee. I still remember when the rift between them became publicly irreconcilable. It was at a new moon festival, a 2 or 3 day festival held in the court of the king. All the leading members of the nation were there, generals and captains of the army like myself, tribal leaders and the heads of clans and key families. They were all gathered together. David wasn't there on the first night of the festival when nobody really paid too much attention to it, but on the second night, when he was absent again, Saul asked Jonathan, "Where's David?" Or rather, he asked, "Where is the son of Jesse?" He no longer even wanted to use his name. And this wasn't a question asked, you know, over a plate of food. This was a question asked of Jonathan in the court. The whole place heard the question, and everyone heard Jonathan's answer. That David had asked to go home for a family sacrifice, and Jonathan had allowed him to. Plausible, but unlikely. Everyone knew it, and so did Saul. And then he said the quiet part out loud. In front of everyone gathered together, he said to Jonathan that unless David dies, Jonathan will never be king. And everyone heard Jonathan's answer. What has he done? He doesn't deserve to die. Saul lost it. Threw a spear at Jonathan. Jonathan left. But the dynamic between that was actually played out in thousands of conversations everywhere in the kingdom. Whose side are you on? Saul's or David's? And that decision was really important, because if you said David, that was really risky. When David had fled, he stopped at the town of Nob, where the priests of the Lord, until recently, had ministered before the Lord. Ahimelech, the high priest, had greeted him, had welcomed him, had given some food, and inquired of the Lord for him. But when Saul learned that he had helped David in any kind of way, he charged them with treason, had them executed, and put the town to the sword. That kind of news gets around. Pretty soon, David was persona non grata everywhere in Israel, even in the tribe of Judah, his own tribe. Retreating further and further and further into the wilderness to try to maintain some distance. This story presents clearly the challenge we faced. It was a while ago now, but the town of Keilah, down in the south, close to the Philistine border, a town that had walls around it, was attacked by Philistine raiders. They were raiding the threshing floors just after harvest, and David heard of it, and so he inquired of the Lord about whether we should go and save the town. The Lord said, yes, save the town. And all of us, the 600 of us who followed him, said, no, we cannot do that. And it wasn't because we were afraid of the Philistines. The Lord would hand them over to us. That wasn't the problem. It was the politics. To save the city would have been immediately a politicized act, doing what Saul should have been doing, claiming authority and doing something that the king ought to do. It would have been a disaster. We were so skeptical that David actually inquired of the Lord a second time. And when the Lord said, go up and save the city, we went up and saved the city. And the Lord gave the Philistines into our hands, and we won a famous victory, and we plundered them and brought it all back to the town, and they were super grateful. Until they heard that Saul was coming to besiege the city and forced them to hand us over to him. And their gratitude evaporated, and it became very clear that there was no love lost. And so we retreated further. It's so easy to trust in the timing of God when things are going smoothly. What we needed wasn't more men. It wasn't more swords. What we needed was wisdom. And she arrived just in time. Abigail of Carmel rode into the ravine just as we were coming down out of the hill country, like Lady Wisdom herself. It's sheep shearing season, you know that, the festive time. Well, while we've been in the wilderness, we have been trying to foster some goodwill amongst the Judean princes. And so whenever we have run into flocks and herds of the nobles and the aristocracy, we have done our best to protect them. And many of the Judean princes have benefited from David's shepherding of their flocks. We've done everything we can to be upright in all of our interactions. And one of the Judean princes who has benefited is a fellow named Nabal, stupendously wealthy and incredibly influential in Judean politics. Well, it's sheep shearing season. It's a festive time, a time for the giving and receiving of gifts and for banqueting. And so David sent myself and a few men to Nabal's property in Carmel to, well, basically ask for a gift. And I know what it sounds like. It sounds like some sort of protection racket. It sounds like some sort of shakedown, but that's not what was going on. This was an opportunity for us to gauge the level of support amongst Judean nobility, to find out what kind of support David had, and to give Nabal an opportunity under the relative safety of a festive season to indicate his support for David through a gift. No one would accuse Nabal of being political, of taking David's side, if all he did was give a gift at sheep shearing time. As we made our way into Carmel, we went past the monument that Saul had set up after one of his victories. Even though the king was far away at the time, his presence was there. Well, Nabal received us himself, and I greeted him in David's name, wished him long life and good health to him and all that were part of his family. And then I asked that he give us whatever could be found for his son David and for us, his servants. Oh, I chafed against the obsequious language, but I knew I needed to do it. He was too important. I knew something was wrong when he made us wait. And wait. And wait. And the longer we stood, with no water brought to quench our thirst or to wash our feet, no oil to anoint our heads, with servants scurrying around preparing for a feast, only casting sidelong glances at us, my apprehension grew. And finally, after a delay that was designed to offend, Nabal came out with his chief steward behind him. And it was evident that he hadn't been in deep council. He'd been in the kitchen. He was wiping his hands of some greasy meat and threw the cloth to his steward, who did not make eye contact with me. And when Nabal spoke, I knew why. Who is David? Who is this son of Jesse? Lots of slaves are running away from their masters these days. The steward winced. The men behind me gasped. This was gobsmackingly insulting. Who is David? Who is David? Using the derogatory term that Saul uses, the son of Jesse, just assuming that David is no better than any other runaway slave and that we, the ones standing before him, are just runaway slaves of a runaway slave? He wasn't done. He said, why should I take the bread and the wine and the meat that I've slaughtered for my shearers and give it to men who have come from who knows where? He hadn't slaughtered those sheep for his shearers. He was about to hold a banquet, not just for himself or for his household, but for all the leading men of Judah, all the leaders of that region. He was gathering them together. But he didn't lump David with those mighty and esteemed guests. No, he put him lower than even his sheep shearers. Some guy who come from some place who doesn't deserve a thing. And with that, he turned on his heel and left. All the color had drained out of the steward's face. He knew how dangerous this was. Before we turned to leave, I leaned in and stated to him the first part of a well-known proverb. The wrath of a king is a messenger of death. And he responded with the second part, but the wise appease it. I have no idea how he thinks he's going to. We returned to the camp and things went exactly as I thought. David was furious. Within an hour of our having received that insult from Nabal, 400 of us were already on the way back armed for battle. David was angry. All his good had been met with evil. He swore an oath before the Lord that not a single man in Nabal's household would be alive the next morning. And she arrived just in time. Abigail of Carmel rode into the ravine as we were coming down out of the hill country, bent on violence. For all of David's anger, for the momentum of his oath, there was something about this beautiful and powerful woman riding down the slope and then quickly dismounting and prostrating herself on the ground before us that gave David pause. She looked at him and said, "Please pardon your servant. Hear what I have to say." I didn't think there was anyone who could say anything or do anything to appease David. I had never seen him so angry. But something about her. So he gave a curt nod. And she gave an unforgettable speech. "Pay no attention, my lord, to that wicked man, Nabal. Not my husband, but to that wicked man. His name is like he is. His name means fool, and folly goes with him." That was unexpected. When she rode into the valley, we assumed that she had been sent by her husband, that this was some other ploy, another insult, some other ruse, some other thing that we had to deal with. It's fairly evident from what she said that she was not representing her husband at all. She was there under her own agency. She went on. What she said next was so curious. She said, "As for me, your servant, I did not see the men that you had sent." David looked at me, asking without a word if that was true, and I nodded. We had not seen Abigail when we had been in Nabal's house. She's the kind of woman you don't forget if you see. Abigail was following his gaze, and when he returned to look at her, she said this: "As surely as the Lord your God lives, who has kept you this day from bloodshed and from taking vengeance into your own hands, now may all who oppose you become like Nabal." Very clever. Very bold. David had not decided that bloodshed was off the menu. He was still angry. But she drops this in as if it had been decided, as if his quest, as if his oath could be set aside. And it was enough just to kind of cause him to take a step back. And she pressed her slight advantage. "And may these gifts that I have brought to you be given to the men who follow after you." At which point the servants streamed around her, bringing these donkeys laden with food. And to put Nabal's wealth in perspective, he never missed 200 loaves of bread, 2 giant wineskins of wine, 5 dressed sheep, heaps of roasted grain, 100 fig cakes, and 200 pressed raisin cakes. Never missed it. Well, there were some murmurs of appreciation amongst the men as all this food came forward until David raised his hand for silence. A gift of food and some disparaging comments about Nabal were not enough to decide this. And Abigail, realizing that danger still hung over her head, continued. "Pardon my presumption," she said, but the Lord your God will surely give you a lasting dynasty because you fight the Lord's battles and no wickedness is found in you. Which sounds like she's just laying it on thick, doesn't it? But there's more. She was indicating that she really understood the times. When Saul and the prophet Samuel had fallen out, there were two really public events in which that took place. The first was at the Michmash Pass. Saul had not waited for Samuel to arrive, and instead of waiting, had offered the sacrifice early. And when Samuel had arrived, he had said to Saul that you've done a foolish thing. If you had waited, the Lord would have given you a lasting dynasty. Abigail takes those words and uses them for David, saying to David that the Lord will give you a lasting dynasty and hinting that it would be because he would wait. Because David at that point in time was done waiting. He was done waiting for the Lord's timing. He was intent on making a statement, a declaration about who he was and who the people of Judah should fear. He was done waiting, and she asks him to wait. When Saul and Samuel fell out for good, it was because of his failed battle against the Amalekites. He'd won, but he hadn't destroyed them as the Lord had. He had failed in the Lord's battle. And when he did so, Samuel had said to him that you have done a wicked thing in rebelling against the Lord's command. A coincidence that she would use that language in her speech to David? I think not. She went on. And even though someone, not naming Saul, is seeking to take your life will be held securely in the bundle of the living while your enemies are hurled away like from the pocket of a sling. Nice. It reminded me at that moment of Jonathan. A couple of months ago, we'd been running around the hills, hiding from Saul and his men, and Jonathan had found us. And he had come to spend some time with David, and a few of us were with him. And he reminded David of the promises of God, that he would be king, that the Lord would be faithful, and he would just need to hold on. And when Jonathan left that day, David was a changed man. He had found strength again in the Lord, and Abigail did the same. Because she continued by saying, when the Lord has given all of the promises, when he has done all that he has promised for you, then my Lord will not have upon his conscience the staggering burden of needless bloodshed and of vengeance. And she laid out in stark terms what we were about to do. By refusing to wait for the Lord's timing and instead taking matters into our own hands, we were about to do something monumentally foolish. And she did it without once calling David a fool. It's brilliant. And she wasn't done. Her final words were these. And when the Lord has granted you success and you have come into your kingdom, remember me. Looks like it's lost on you. Let me explain. What she was saying was, good things come to those who wait, and I am a good thing. What she was saying to David is that if he would wait until the Lord's time and until the Lord brought him to the throne, then there was a chance of a political alliance, a marriage between himself and her. A beautiful, discerning, powerful woman. A much softer approach to getting an in with the Judean leadership than what he was proposing. When David spoke, his voice was thick with emotion. I think because he realized what had just happened. He had been saved. Oh, Nabal had been saved as well. His family had been saved. All the Judean leaders who had aligned themselves with him were saved, but David had been saved. Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who has sent you to me today. May the Lord bless you for your discernment and for your good judgment. For as surely as the Lord lives, if you had not come quickly to me, not one member of Nabal's family would still be alive tomorrow. The Lord who has sent you to me has kept me from bloodshed and from taking vengeance. Go home in peace. I have heard your request and have granted it. The whole glade breathed. I don't remember when I started holding my breath, only that when David said those words, I was able to breathe again. Abigail got up, bowed to David, mounted the donkey, and turned and returned home, leading the servants behind her. Going to the feast, I've found myself wondering how Nabal's going to take it when he finds out what she's done, and I reckon she can probably handle herself. But as we made our way back to camp, leading these donkeys laden with food, there was only one topic of conversation: Abigail. Some who hadn't seen her before commented on her beauty. But as we all know, charm is deceptive. Beauty is fleeting. But a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. And we praised her. We praised her for her quick action. In the time it took us to return to David and to make our way back, she had not only managed to squander all of those supplies, but actually to come up with the most brilliant and unforgettable speech I've ever heard. We praised her for her boldness in both defending her husband while distancing herself from him. We praised her gentle words that had soothed anger. We praised her wisdom and her recognition of what God has done. She arrived just in time.
Thanks for listening to this sermon podcast. We hope you found inspiration and encouragement, and God used this message to speak to you. If you want to connect more with GBC, you can follow us on social media or contact us via our website. You can also get to know some of the people from our church community through the We Are the Church podcast. Real stories of real people sharing how Jesus has shaped and transformed their life. We pray you experience the transforming power of Jesus in your life, and pray that God blesses you today.